Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria, and it's with a really heavy heart today that I must announce to some of you that this may be new news. To many of you who have been online all day, this may be old news, but Oliver Sacks passed away. He was probably the greatest influence on my career, and even though I never knew him personally, I would be remiss if I didn't call him something of a mentor to me. I learned so much reading his work, and I don't think that I would have found science, especially not the science of the brain, of consciousness, and of behavior, if it weren't for the tremendous influence that he had on the field of neurology. I woke up very sad this morning. I've been very sad throughout the day. And I just hope that with the passing of this great man, we can take an opportunity to learn as much as we possibly can from him. If you guys don't know much about Dr. Oliver Sacks, I recommend starting with the book that had the most profound influence on me, and that was The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. It's written absolutely beautifully. He writes clinical tales of traumatic brain injury and sometimes even congenital brain injury. He writes these nonfiction tales almost as though they're fiction. They're just immensely readable and incredibly personal. And through the study of individuals who have had great losses in their lives through brain damage, I think he's really done a good job of helping us understand our own brains and minds, the capacities of them, the limitations of them, and also how limitless they truly can be. I wanted to read a quick quote at the top of the show that he said in The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. "To live on a day-to-day basis is insufficient for human beings. We need to transcend, transport, escape. We need meaning, understanding, and explanation. We need to see overall patterns in our lives. We need hope, the sense of a future. And we need freedom, or at least the illusion of freedom, to get beyond ourselves, whether with telescopes and microscopes and our ever-burgeoning technology, or in states of mind that allow us to travel to other worlds, to rise above our immediate surroundings. We may seek, too, a relaxing of inhibitions that makes it easier to bond with each other, or transports that make our consciousness of time and mortality easier to bear. We seek a holiday from our inner and outer restrictions, a more intense sense of here and now, the beauty and value of the world we live in." We'll miss you very much, Dr. Sacks. All right, guys, I'm excited about the episode today, but before I introduce my very special guest, I want to thank a few people who have made this week's episode possible. I want to thank John McCallany, I think that's how you pronounce that, from South Carolina. Thank you so much, John. I also would like to thank Phil Thibbert, Timothy Glover, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, and Chuck Pell. Thank you so much for your continued support. You and a number of other people make Talk Nerdy possible for everyone to listen to and for it to remain 100% free to download. You can find Talk Nerdy via iTunes or Stitcher or however you found it, because you're obviously listening to it right now. All right, guys, I'm really excited about this week's guest. I think it's one of the more profound conversations that I've had in quite a while, and it piggybacks off of the story that I told last week about our fan from Saudi Arabia who reached out and was fearing for his life because he was afraid that his father was going to turn him in for apostasy since he was a non-believer. The man who really made it possible to mobilize, to ensure that passports were all in order, that we could get this man safely to the United States, was Faisal Saeed Al-Muhtar. He is a proponent of religious freedom and human rights. He was actually born in Iraq and only quite recently made his way to the United States. He works full-time as a public speaker, a human rights activist, a writer, and a community manager, and he is the founder of the Global Secular Humanist Movement. Please welcome Faisal Saeed Al-Muttar. Faisal, thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to join me today on Talk Nerdy.
Thank you so much for inviting me. We came into an interesting event that happened recently with the Saudi guy, so it's a great pleasure.
Yes, I am really excited both to talk about the work that you're doing because I think it's so instrumental and I think that so many of my listeners are going to respond really positively to it, but also to talk about this one specific event, which I think in some ways kind of brought us together. So maybe that's a good place to start. You mentioned this this Saudi guy. Some people listening also follow me on social media, so they may have seen. How long ago was this now? Maybe 2 weeks ago only?
Yeah.
If that?
Yeah, about that. Yeah, it's about 10 days. Yeah.
Yeah, 10 days ago. And they may have seen some conversation. This was probably mostly via Twitter or Facebook. So my background, I'll kind of tell you what came up on my end, and then hopefully you can fill in those gaps for me. Basically, a fan reached out to me through Facebook and left me a short message that said that he was very concerned. He was living in Saudi Arabia. He had been open with his father that he was a non-believer, and his father did not respond well, and he was worried that his father threatened that he would be taking the case to the authorities. And of course, this worried me immediately because in Saudi Arabia, saying that you're an atheist or saying that you don't believe is more than just a faux pas. It's against the law. It's against Sharia law. And this could have had really dire consequences. It's actually punishable by death. So my concern was, oh no, what do I do? He was asking for my advice. I have no idea what to do in this case. So I basically said, maybe you should go to the American embassy. I'm not really sure, but that's the best advice I have. Let me ask around. And I posted online that this is what I told him, and does anybody have any better advice? And through interactions with different fans and different people on social media, that's how Sarah Moorhead from Recovering from Religion, who I know quite well over the past few years, and also you, Faisal, that's how the three of us really started communicating, but also that's how a bunch of fans really banded together to start showing their support, both financially, but also just through know-how. So why don't you kind of take the story from there and tell me how things were happening on your end?
Yeah, well, Sarah Moorhead contacted me, and she did mention that there is this case, and there's a person in Saudi Arabia. And considering that that's partially part of my full-time job, that I do a lot of background checking and I try to connect activists in closed societies with people in the free societies who can help them. So I immediately took his Skype ID and then started a conversation with him, asked him some questions about like what is really the case, what passports does he have, how emergent is the case, and things of that sort. And I mean, I consider that this is like one of the easiest cases I've ever handled because he happens to have an American passport because he was born in the United States. So technically, he didn't need a visa to come to the United States. He can just come in. So his most issue was the financial. So I did some background checking. I made sure that he was legit, and his story matches the facts on the ground. And we booked him a flight ticket, and he came over here.
And he actually had to kind of do some dangerous maneuvering on his side to sneak away from the house when his father was asleep to make sure that he could you know get away without alerting anybody so that he would be at the airport before anybody was informed.
Yeah, exactly. Which is kind of, his case resembles a lot of the issues that's happening right now because when it comes to issue of apostasy. I mean, as far as he told me, like he said that his dad is going to report him to the authorities in a very short time. And so within that, the same nights, like when we are working on his issue and like on his case, like his dad was not talking to him. So like their relationship was going very stressful. And he was, it was like very close that he's going to report the authorities, as far as I know. That's why, like, it was kind of an emergent case from the behavior of his parents. I mean, it was pretty stressful. I mean, he had to sneak. So his parents, like, I mean, think like wake up at 6 a.m. or something of that sort. Mm-hmm. So he had to sneak out before that and try to not to make any noise. And he went to the airport. And while they thought that he was sleeping, he was actually at the airport waiting for his flight to the United States.
And he had to basically bring everything he wanted to keep with him, because when you make a decision like this, which is a big decision to make, and granted, it may seem easy to us in the West, or it may seem easy to those of us who are out loud and proud atheists who have the protections of the law that say that it's okay for us to be this way. But when you make a decision to say, you know what, I can't lie anymore, I can't pretend to be Muslim in order to stay in this country, I have to go with my true thoughts and beliefs and go to America so that I can have those protections, so that I don't have to practice Islam. You're also making the decision that says, I will never go back to Saudi Arabia, and I will probably not see my parents again unless they decide to come visit me.
Yeah, definitely. Assuming that his parents are okay with his atheism. I mean, mm-hmm. If you look at some of the stories of the people who escaped, left Islam. For me, I got lucky because my parents are progressive, but for many family, like for many people, it means the ending of the relationship with their family.
Yeah, and also with their life, with their culture. And it's easy, again, I think, for some people in the West to say, yeah, but the culture wants to kill you. The culture doesn't support you. And why would you ever want to go back? But, like, honestly, imagine if the place where you were, not for, in his case, he wasn't born there, but I do think that he grew up there. If
yeah,
the place where you spent most of your life, where all of your extended family is, where all of your friends are, and where everything that you hold dear culturally, just immediately you decide to walk away from. It's not an easy decision to make, even if that culture is one that doesn't accept you.
Yeah, not at all. And leave aside, like, when somebody leaves, and that's, I mean, I can speak for myself here, is that you start getting lots of hate mail from the people who you escaped, so it never leaves you.
Sure.
Obviously it's safer here, but sometimes even within, like, the Muslim community here in the United States, there's also some level of discrimination against those who are atheists and non-believers. Mm-hmm. But obviously, it doesn't reach to the level of killing. But I don't think that is a good standard to begin with. So, like, sometimes...
Yeah, exactly. That's the worst it can be.
Yeah.
So, okay, you're a pariah. Maybe, the government's not going to kill you, but you're still a pariah. That's...
Yeah, exactly. And For new immigrants, they do need people to support them, or some people who can relate to easily. But when it comes to, like, people who are atheists from Muslim world, or they hardly find anyone from their community to help them.
Yeah, that must be really tough. So that kind of brings me, and now just to kind of put a button on the story, I think that they are still raising money through the portal at Recovering from Religion, which is a nonprofit that helps in this kind of a situation, because basically that plane ticket for this individual was not cheap. I mean, when you try to buy a plane ticket from Saudi Arabia to the United States, like, with one day's notice, if that, it's not cheap. Even with the horrible layover he had to suffer through and had to really, like, have his eyes on his over his shoulders the whole time until he was here safely. So I know that he's not out of the woods financially. He came here. He doesn't have a support system yet. He doesn't have a job yet. So a lot of people are working on trying to make this individual comfortable through this transition, make sure that he can get into, maybe even into therapy or see the support groups that he needs to see, get into the right community settings that he needs to be in, and then start the whole process of getting a job and moving away from temporary housing into permanent housing. It's expensive, and it requires a lot of effort. So if you're interested in supporting both this case but also that cause, I think that the portal is still up, and you can do that anytime at recoveringfromreligion.org. org. So that's the button on it. He is here safely, but it's a long road ahead. Now, I use this example because it's so relevant and because it's something that I, you know, felt like I was a part of more recently. But this is something that you do quite often, isn't it?
Yes. So my full-time job is actually focused on helping activists in closed societies and connect them with people in open societies who can help them. So the distinction is made by Freedom House, which is an organization that kind of puts the range in which countries have a free press and freedom of expression or things of that sort, countries which don't. So I'm focused on that. So we created a platform in which people in the closed societies can sign up and make requests. Like, I'm looking for media coverage, I'm looking for web designer, I'm looking for funding, etc. And then people from free societies, they can make offers. Like, I am a web designer, I'm a journalist, I'm a writer, etc. So we helped like many activists, including countries from Saudi Arabia, which is a country I'm very much focused on, to get them published in the media, get their stories out there, sometimes help them with funding. So that's what I do on a day-to-day basis.
And let's talk, before we get into, I guess, the nitty-gritty of that and what some of your experiences and stories are, let's talk about why and how you came to be doing this for a living. Because you yourself, you know, grew up in one of these closed societies, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Iraq, which took an interesting turn after the US invasion. People thought that we're going to turn to an open society, but unfortunately, due to the rise of terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and others, we did not really become fortunate to have the freedom. So, yeah, I mean, I grew up my childhood under Saddam Hussein, if you call him a monster, it's a compliment. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, we start having terrorist groups popping off left and right, and now we have ISIS. So, I mean, I consider myself old school because I was with Al-Qaeda, not with ISIS. So,
yeah.
So I was dealing with the liberals, not the conservatives. Because of the environment that I was surrounded in, I used to also writing about this subject anonymously and things of that sort, and then I started getting threats left and right. So I also lost my brother in the civil war and my cousin, and I had to leave Iraq by end of 2009. And then I went to Lebanon, then I went to Malaysia, then I came to the United States, and I came to the United States as a refugee.
And so that decision to leave Iraq in 2009, when you say you had to, was it because you were fearing for your safety?
For the most part, yes. There are so many. I started getting notes. I mean, Al-Qaeda came into my high school and they tried to kidnap me. I mean, if that is not a good note, then I don't know what is. Start getting, the situation started getting worse and worse with the sectarian warfare and everything. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I made the decision that the moment I'm going to finish high school, I really need to get out of the country. And I went to Lebanon because, I mean, I have an Iraqi passport, so I cannot go to the West immediately. So, and I applied to the UK and I got rejected. So I had to apply for a refugee status, but I have to do it outside the country because I cannot stay in the country and apply because that would mean I would get killed. So I went to Lebanon and Malaysia, and then I got to the United States. So that was like 2 years ago. So I'm only a new immigrant to this country.
So you were able to go to Lebanon, basically like you traveled there as if you were traveling for vacation. And then once you were there, you were able to apply for that refugee status.
Yes. I went with visitor visa, and then I stayed in Lebanon for a while before I applied for refugee. I applied eventually in Malaysia because in Lebanon it's too crowded with refugees. So it makes it so hard to actually get even an appointment to make an interview. So I went to Malaysia also to study, and it also has a better education. I also needed to escape the Middle East as a whole because it's so integrated, and it's like even if there are so many issues and so many terrorist groups that work across the region, so they're not only limited to Iraq. So Malaysia was kind of a safer place for me. And from there, I applied to the UNHCR, and there is like an office for Iraqis, so that makes it easier to apply and everything. That's like technically the average story for activists. I mean, it's very difficult, or like very difficult for those who are living in closed societies and in danger to immediately escape from there to the free societies. They generally had to go through transitional countries until they eventually go to a safer country.
And I mean, that makes sense. So once you're in Malaysia and you're able to apply there for refugee status, how was it that you were able to get to the United States and actually immigrate here?
Yeah, I applied through the UNHCR, which is the United Nations Commissions for Refugees.
Okay.
And so people go do an appointment and they try to gather a story, and then they ask you which country you want to be allocated in. And because I had relatives here in the United States, so I chose it and also want to live in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that's the main reason. So I put some information there, and I did some waiting, and then I eventually get accepted.
Yeah. So it's not only is it a long process, you know, when it comes to doing everything above the board and doing it legitimately with paperwork and getting acceptance, it also sounds like it's an expensive process. Like, it's not cheap and easy to hop a flight to another country, then live there where you have no resources, and then apply to go to another country and then start there from scratch again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's why you see many of the people are actually stuck, because, I mean, I consider myself privileged in some sense, because my parents paid some of my education, and Malaysia was not much of an expensive country, so that's kind of good. But yeah, it is a very difficult process for a lot of people. And the older somebody gets, the harder it gets.
Sure.
Because like when it comes to applying for jobs and things of that sort, and considering that education system of some of these closed societies is extremely terrible, so generally they don't really get jobs that actually pay a living.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it more difficult.
Also, if you're trying to, you know, bring your family over, if you have children, that's a whole other layer that gets complicated. And I can only imagine that as a woman, just getting away and getting to safety and being able to do all of these things coming from, like you called it, a closed society where women aren't even allowed potentially to walk the streets without a chaperone.
Yeah, I mean, it depends case by case, but mm-hmm. I would say like in countries like Saudi Arabia, which I would consider the most extreme before ISIS. So Saudi Arabia and ISIS has a lot in common, actually.
Yeah.
So I would consider it as one of the most difficult countries. But I mean, even other countries, especially in Southeast Asia, it's also very difficult for them to get a visa to go to the Western world, because there are so many people who want to apply for a visa to go to the Western world. So there's huge numbers of people applying. And so, I mean, in countries like in the West that try to get the professionals mostly. So... Mm-hmm. In that way, they try, like, I mean, the people who are activists and stuff may not fit into that category. So generally, they get ignored as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's all difficult.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, and that's, like you said, somebody who's an activist, for example, doesn't fit into that category as a professional unless they have a law degree or they have something where they can come here and it seems like they're, you know, quote unquote, contributing to society. But imagine like our Saudi friend who wanted to come over. He's an atheist, or at least he's a self-proclaimed non-believer. But I don't know if he's an activist. I just think he wants to live his life in peace. You know,
yeah,
I don't know if he wants to actually affect change and do all of this crazy work on top of that, like you do, which we also appreciate. I think a lot of people, you know, sometimes their mind is made up once they move and they realize, oh, now that I have these freedoms, I can help others. But some people, you know, they just want to live in peace.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't really recommend anyone to be like me. It's a very stressful life. It's a very stressful life to begin with. But yeah, I mean, if there is something I think the atheist community can do, or like especially those who work in public policy and things of that sort, is try to lobby the government to make it easier for people who are atheists to come to the United States easily. I mean, because, and if you look at other religious minorities in the Muslim world, like Christians and Yazidis and so on, they do like their communities here in the West, they do some lobbying to make it easier for these people to get visas. So maybe that's something we can do.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where we think of ourselves, and we are very progressive and very free, and we have a free press, and we're protected. Our religious liberty is protected by law. But still in the West, there is a lot of stigma, and there is a kind of a Christian privilege here. So that I think we're very concerned, like you said, about religious minorities in these areas. But the atheists in these areas, obviously, I think legally, our country is structured so that they would have protection, but it's less of a story, isn't it? From a journalistic perspective, it's like people don't feel as guilty or they don't feel as bad for those poor, quote unquote, atheists.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's even here in the United States, as you mentioned, I mean, there is a lot of stigma against atheism per se. I mean, I don't know if there's this poll which says like, atheists and rapists are actually very close when it comes to like trust among the American public. So that's a bit of a problem.
Yeah, and I mean we are in this country so, I guess, racist or xenophobic, you could say, towards Muslim individuals, as it is, obviously, because of this longstanding history where we can't understand the difference between a moderate Muslim and an extremist. But even on polls that show who would we elect to public office, we trust atheists still less than Muslims, even.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that has something to do with the Cold War, that the United States, like between the United States and the Soviet Union, that kind of played some role. Because like the Soviet Union was, they mixed the Soviet Union with atheism and communism, and while America was the Christian capitalist. So there, I mean, that's where like In God We Trust came in and all of that. So I think there's, because if you look at other European countries, I mean, like in Sweden or Denmark or Finland or Norway and even like in the UK, they have much less stigma against atheists than here in the United States. Even in Canada, they have it less. But I think in America, everything is so polarized and political. I mean, that's my view as an immigrant. Everything is like you're either with us or with the devil. There's hardly a room for like a nuanced view. As you mentioned, like the difference between Muslim extremists and Muslim moderates. And so like here, like because I go a lot of debates in this country about like the question of Islam and the relationship with terrorism and so on. And so like it's generally like either or, most of the stuff either black and white, either that all Muslims are the devil or all Muslims are just wonderful. Like you can hardly have a discussion between like the spectrum of religious belief, the connection between religious belief, extreme religious belief and consequences and so on. Like it's so polarized. So like if you say something against Islam, you're immediately lumped in with Dick Cheney and George W. Bush or Pamela Gellar or whatever. If you say something pro-Muslim, they will be lumped in with apologists and all of that. So it's a very polarized country.
And so here you are, an ex-Muslim who is working to protect the civil rights of atheists. I mean, these are two of the most reviled groups. It must be very hard to get the kind of support that you need to be able to move forward, at least here in this country.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no, I would say. I mean, I would say I have it better than many people because, I mean, I mean, my focus, I wouldn't say it's focused only on atheists from the Muslim world, but my story of activism started about trying to build civil society institutions and try to fight against sectarianism in Iraq. So I would consider myself a secular, more into secular approach than I'm not trying to save atheism, but I would say try to create a secular society in which atheists and non-atheists can be treated equally under the law. So, yes, I mean, obviously there are, like, I would say, hatred from both sides. Is it when it comes to the right wing or extreme right wing, It's obviously because I'm brown, immigrant, and atheist. It cannot get worse. And when it comes to the left or the far left, it's like, oh, he's critical of Islam and he's a Uncle Tom and he is a sad nigger and all of these kinds of stuff. And I didn't really expect that I would hear it from people on the left. But so like it's so polarized. I get hatred from two sides who generally don't agree on anything. So sometimes I feel happy that I can unite Americans. That's actually a good thing.
That is so sad to hear that from the left you're actually getting like this kind of xenophobic hatred. This like it's such a convoluted view that there's so much, I guess, liberal guilt around around what they call quote unquote Islamophobia, that we have to be so sensitive around that somebody who actually grew up in these culture and is like actively rejecting it, like, no, I lived there, I went through this and it's horrible, I'm telling you, that somebody would really be like, oh, you can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, I've read a lot about this subject and there are so many people who wrote as well, is that I think that it's another form. I mean, there was this famous discussion about Sam Harris and Ben Affleck, about when Ben Affleck called Sam Harris a gross and racist. And then I wrote an article for Inquiry magazine and I said, who is really gross and racist? So I mean, I'll give you a bit of a summary about it, is that it's actually, I mean, the left, I mean, I would say the far left, obviously not all the left, but the far left are the ones who are really the ones who are gross and racist, because they're the ones who are applying different standards to different people. Is that when you say that, okay, I'm going to criticize this white guy because he's against gay marriage and I'm going to call him a bigot, but I'm not going to criticize a brown person for saying the same thing, then that is racism.
Yeah, it's this extreme cultural relativism that actually...
Exactly, yes. When somebody, I mean, it's pure and simple. If somebody applies different standards to different people because of their race, he's a racist. Whether you're going to say all Chinese people are smart, all Chinese people are stupid, it is still racist.
Yeah.
Because you're generalizing purely on the ethnic basis. And there is this, as you mentioned, the white guilt phenomena about Western imperialism and things of that sort has something to do with it. I mean, I'm not a fan of imperialism, not that I think it's a good idea. But at the same time, I mean, there are things that has happened and happening that has nothing to do with Western imperialism. I mean, there are things like, for example, treatment of gays. I mean, if ISIS throws gays out of buildings, what this has to do with U.S. invasion of Iraq? Or like because white people occupied it's purely has something a lot to do with the culture. It's not like ISIS came out of nowhere. Like the beliefs of ISIS has nothing to do, has no legitimacy within cultures that has nothing, no Western imperialism.
Yeah,
like,
no, I mean, so many, did you read so that Atlantic things. Article about yeah. ISIS? You know, that yeah. it's like basically ISIS is actually deeply Muslim.
Yeah, I mean, if the, I think the Pew research, which has been done about like Islam public Sharia, is, I think it's pretty good, because the generally, like if you look at the mainstream media, they generally ask people, do you support ISIS? Do you not support ISIS? This is a very stupid question to begin with, because it's purely regional. There's a lot of geopolitical issues. Mm-hmm. But if you look at all the actions that ISIS is doing, if you take 10 of them, like killing apostates, killing a woman for being immodest or things of that sort, you'll see that these beliefs are shared across the Muslim world.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, ISIS has taken it quite far in terms of like what they really define as an apostate. But the penalty for apostasy is death within mainstream Islam. And that is something that Muslims have to reconcile with in trying to reform their religion. Is that, yes, I mean, when it comes to ISIS, they consider a lot of people who are even Shia Muslims or et cetera as apostates. But still, the punishment for apostasy is death. So they just took it further about who they define as an apostate.
Mm-hmm.
But the punishment, I mean, the moment somebody says, oh, the punishment for apostasy is death, this something can be stretched to mean anything, depends on the interpretation. But as long as they reject these interpretations to begin with, that the punishment for apostasy should not be death, then you're going to see change in extremism. But at the same time, yes, what ISIS is doing, it's shared a lot. I mean, not all everything, but some of the main things that they're doing is shared a lot. It's just that they try to make it with great video editing and sound editing and try to make it more public and everything. Everybody's like scared. But these things happen a lot in the Muslim world. I mean, Saudi Arabia does beheadings probably on the same amount as ISIS does.
Ugh. And that's such a crazy thing about this whole story. And I think why I immediately was so afraid for this individual who reached out, because I don't have a lot of personal experience with these things. You know, I can rattle off about them on my podcast, but I live in Los Angeles and I live a pretty privileged life. And I was raised Mormon. I dealt with a different kind of religious, I guess, I don't know how I would word it, but I grew up with a different kind of strong religion in my life. But I wasn't actually afraid for my life ever. But when this individual reached out to me, I was really struggling with this idea that we are allies with this country, and that's not okay.
Yeah, I call it the unholy alliance. The way I see it is like there are two unholy alliances that are happening. Is that the unholy alliance that's happening between the far left and the Muslim right,
mm-hmm.
and the alliance between the West and like including countries in the West like UK and other than the United States and Canada with Saudi Arabia and Qatar, who are one of the most extreme nations on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And they consider them allies in actually fighting terrorism, which is kind of very ironic, considering that all evidence suggests that most of what the terrorist groups believe in have a lot to do with the religious beliefs of Wahhabism and Salafism in Saudi Arabia and Qatar.
And so when we say that we consider them allies in fighting terrorism, I mean, that's just pure and simple doublespeak.
It is,
like, where
it
does
is
that come from?
I mean, there's huge history with it, but during the Cold War, the United States had to choose enemies of communism.
Mm-hmm.
And also with the rise of Islamic Revolution of Iran, and they declared the United States as an enemy. So Saudi Arabia capitalized on this, tried to enhance their relationship with the West so they can fight against Iran. And also the existence of oil within these countries. And that is itself very problematic.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be, you know, the simplistic view that is the motivating factor across the board. As long as we can maintain an allegiance with Saudi Arabia and we can import their oil, we are always going to basically look the other way when it comes to human rights abuses. But it's so much deeper than that. It's so much, it's this historical American policy of like, the enemy of our enemy is our friend.
Yeah, it always backfires.
Of course.
I don't know why, but it always backfires.
Because usually the enemy of our enemy is somebody who's even more horrible.
Generally, so that can be applied too. And I really consider like Saudi Arabia as one of the most dangerous examples because, I mean, while I completely agree with you that the United States alliance is very bad, but the problem is, even if the United States and the West going to cut their alliance, let's assume mm-hmm. tomorrow the United States is going to cut their alliance, Russia and China, who are another two superpowers, are still going to buy the oil from Saudi Arabia. Russia and China doesn't care about human rights. Mm-hmm. They don't even have the privilege to have the discussion we are having right now because their citizens are all living under a closed society. So the thing about that Saudi Arabia, that is a country that's going to be rich for a very long time.
Yeah.
Because they have gold, like the equivalent of gold, which is oil. And so unless somebody's trying to favor invasion, which I don't think is ever going to be helpful to invade Saudi Arabia, but
mm-hmm.
I think that a war of ideas is very helpful. And especially, and that's what I'm trying to focus a lot about, is that there are individuals in Saudi Arabia who are liberal and secularist and agree on, believe individual rights and women's rights, etc. Because of by comparison, how much the Saudi government and Wahhabis have a lot of money, they're left behind. That's the reason why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know exactly what it's like to living in Iraq, being a secularist, and then you have giants that you are fighting against. Yeah. And that's why I think where the West or free societies generally kind of play a role in trying to balance it out to some extent. Like, how can secularists fight against ISIS if ISIS has $2 billion of funding, while the secularists hardly have food to eat in the evening? Mm-hmm. There's no, you cannot. So that's why where the West kind of play a role in actually trying to support in any way possible, even within skills, within donations, etc. And I think that's where, because it is an ideology. I mean, I always compare it to HIV and AIDS, is that if you look at these, like ISIS, Boko Haram, Al-Qaeda, etc., or even the Saudi regime and Wahhabism, they are the AIDS, not the HIV. They're the symptom, not the disease. Mm-hmm. The disease is the ideology that is feeding these jihadists. And this ideology has to be fought. It's an ideological warfare. Like, even if we're going to wipe out ISIS tomorrow, there's going to be another ISIS popping up because the belief that is feeding ISIS is still there. The idea of establishing an Islamic caliphate, the idea of killing apostates, the idea of killing women for wearing quote-unquote immodest clothing, this is ideas that we have to fight against. And the thing is, these values that I'm talking about liberalism and secularism, are not purely Western ideals. There are so many people who are in the East who believe in these ideals.
Oh, yeah.
And even they exist within the history of these countries. I mean, if you look at Iraq 40, 50 years ago, women's rights were actually far much better than they are right now.
Mm-hmm.
And Iran, the same case. Like, women in Iran used to have much more rights before the Islamic Revolution than after the Islamic Revolution. So that means that they actually have history of to some extent, of at least secular values and some form of equality. Obviously not the same as the West, and not trying to be cultural relativist, but still far much better than it is right now. So
yeah,
so
they were on a path that did a U-turn.
Yes. So technically, I mean, one of the methods I utilize is that they can just look back at the history of what they were. I mean, these countries were not always like this. I mean, mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia has always been, but if you look at other countries like Iraq and Iran and Syria and Lebanon, etc., Turkey, they have civilizations that existed before, and they have a long history, and culture and arts, and that all can be utilized in trying to let people know that you actually have a history and you had it better before, and you can restore to it, you can go back to it.
So my question for you, I mean, you are somebody who has been in the trenches. You've been on both sides of this. You've both been in the danger zone, and you've been sort of outside of the danger zone, but still doing dangerous work where people's lives are literally at risk. And like you just said, which I think was such an important point that I think bears reiterating, even in these most extreme environments and in these most closed societies, there is a large and vibrant group of individuals who are secularists, who are having to operate in the shadows, who are having to keep their ideas quiet for fear of retribution. And they're getting it from both sides, because they're not just getting it from the extreme regimes, you know, the governmental regimes that may be in power, or the groups like ISIS, or like you said, Boko Haram, or Al-Qaeda, or any of these groups, or even the Taliban. But they're also getting it from this sort of more relaxed culture that reinforces these ideas, this background Islamic culture that's so imbued, right? That's so part of where they grew up, regardless of what the regime in charge is. So you're getting it from both sides. You have an extreme regime that's saying your secular values are potentially punishable by death. And then you have this more background temperature of people who kind of say, well, culturally, we agree with that. That's our religion. You know, like, we're sort of on that team too, maybe not as extreme as it's more extreme than we'd like, but really those are our core values. Or A, do you agree with that? And B, what is your advice for these people? I mean, knowing what a risk they run doing these operations in the shadows.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, I agree with a lot of what he said. Is that, I mean, many of them are actually very brave, that they don't really operate in the shadows.
Mm-hmm.
Is that many of them actually come out. I mean, there is a lot of pages in Arabic about secularism, actually, of people within using their own real names. Wow.
Often are they just put to death or made to be quiet?
I mean, it really depends on country to country, but yeah. I think that I would say it. I mean, that was my feeling when I was there, and I think it's sometimes shared by some of the people, is that we have like reached a point of being fed up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think like the way I saw it, the way I rationalized it, is that somebody only has two choices. I mean, sometimes things are really black and white, is that you either kneel for the terrorists or either you fight them.
Mm.
So like either somebody agrees to live a lie all their lives and trying to simply live a fake life until they die,
mm-hmm.
or try to speak out, try to form a movement that counters that. So, I mean, many of the activists are, I mean, as I said, it depends from country to country. Like in Saudi Arabia, it's obviously the most extreme case. But like in Iraq, for example, in Baghdad, it's still kind of better than other parts of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's called, because the capital city, it's a big city, it's kind of a bit more diverse. I mean, obviously, there's still danger. There are still terrorist groups operating around. And also, I mean, well, you mentioned dictatorships, and that's one of the main reasons why I'm very much against dictatorships, including the ones who are moderates, because like now there is another unholy alliance happening between United States and some other dictatorships in the region. And even though these dictatorships are not ISIS, they don't behead people on the street, they're not that extreme. But what happens is that they kill anybody who pretty much disagrees with them.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is that when they do that, that would lead to more extremism, is that they would only lead the dissidents of that regime will only be the people who don't fear death, who don't care about life at all, who don't care about their families, who don't care about their children. And that's going to be the terrorist groups.
Yeah.
You know, so like dictatorships, like, for example, like Saddam Hussein or Bashar al-Assad or like Sisi now in Egypt and so many other places. Obviously, they're not ISIS. I mean, Saddam was, I would say, I mean, I call him secular, but he's secular compared to ISIS.
Yeah.
So because he killed anybody who disagreed with him, eventually what that led to is that the opposition of Saddam Hussein, many of them, the one who are left, are the only far right in their religion, the Shia extremists, who now became the new Iraqi government. So all the educated, the liberals and all of that, they either were killed or left the country. And what is left out from the opposition are the people who don't fear death, who want to establish an Islamic caliphate under a new sect of Islam. And so like the battle of ideas, if I want to call it this way, it's not only a battle against theocracy, but it's also a battle against authoritarian regime. And I would put theocracy under authoritarianism.
Yeah.
I mean, Hitchens used to call himself anti-authoritarian, and I know the guy, so I follow the same trend of anti-authoritarianism altogether. It's like we have to fight all these forms of authoritarianism, whether it's like, even if it's called quote-unquote secular dictatorship or a theocracy.
And I think that's a good point, and it's something that we talk about a lot on this show, is that, you know, I'm an atheist, but I'm not, you know, fundamentally against religion. Like, I don't believe, and I wonder if the world would be better if there were no religion, but I think that people who practice personal religion can find a lot of good things from this. And I think that religion, historically, can be very helpful in certain people's lives. What I am fully against is when religion creeps its way into governmental structure. And when you start to get to the point where government and religion and power are inextricably linked, that's when you start to see very damaging practices occurring.
Yeah. I mean, you would still have damage. I mean, I would say it really depends on the interpretation of religion. I mean, I live in New York, and we have the ultra-Orthodox community in Brooklyn, and I mean, even though they don't want to interject religion into society, but there's also like issues that happen within that community
yeah.
that are troubling. It comes to like circumcision and people dying because of it and all of that. But yeah, I mean, I would say like extremism and the intersection of religion and government is extremely dangerous. Obviously, I mean, religion has, I mean, sometimes it's like, if you ask another religious person like what he believes in, and then you ask another religious person what he believes in, and then like they give you completely different answers.
So, yeah, even though they're the same faith, and they would consider themselves both like moderate Methodists.
Yeah,
like they'll give
exactly.
you two totally different answers.
Yeah, like if you ask, so like it really depends on how, I mean, if we're going to put the value as, let's say, the standard value is a human rights and civil society, etc., I would definitely can argue that there are so many people within who people of faith who belong to that category, like
yeah.
people like the Quakers and the Presbyterians and like the Church of England sometimes, who follow interpretations that are completely compatible with that. There are interpretations within, I mean, within even within Christianity and so is Islam and Judaism that mm-hmm. are not compatible with that. And mm-hmm. So it's really about filtering out which ones are the compatible, which ones are not. But, I mean, when it comes to, I think in the 21st century, I would count radical Islam as the most dangerous of all. Because it is, I mean, both religions, Judaism and Christianity, has gone through some form of enlightenment. Not all enlightenment, but some form of it. Mm-hmm. While Islam is now doing the process. It's happening. I can see it within huge discussion in the Arab media about reformation, and so is here in the Western media about this. So it's happening right now, but there is a still significant number of Muslims. And I'm speaking about the ones who live in the Middle East and Southeast Asia, who make up the majority, not like the ones who live in Orange County. So
yeah, and it's
so,
taken so long. I mean, it's not like Islam is a new faith. It's not like, you know, Christianity and Judaism, they went through these enlightenment issues because they're an older religion.
No,
you know what I mean?
I mean,
I wonder how long it would actually take, and if it's ever even possible that we would see a future with only progressive and moderate Islam.
I mean, I definitely think it's possible and I can see it, but I can also argue that it's very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes to this, like, because we have this word religion, and generally people think that all religions have the same beliefs, have the same ideas, and they all agree on everything. They actually don't. I mean, there are so many things that are specific about each faith that makes it distinct from the other on subjects, and that includes... Mm-hmm. Like when it comes to Islam, I mean, for example, the Quran was written during the life of the Prophet, and then like being published as a book, I think after he died. So it's not like Jesus. After a while, then they published the New Testament. So like the time period makes a difference in how people view the book. So people generally view the book as the literal word of the creator of the universe. That's
mm-hmm.
That kind of makes it hard to have the discussion about whether it's written by has mistakes or doesn't have mistakes. So
yeah, it's hard not to have a fundamentalist interpretation there.
I would say so. I mean, it's hard to. I mean, I read a lot of Book of Reformers and things of that sort, but I would say that they have to do lots of work to get the conclusion that Islam supports equality for women. Like,
yeah.
it is a lot of work. Like, and then eventually, I mean, that's my view is that sometimes they have to take views that are outside the Quran to support their arguments. So. Like they use a verse and then they try to interject a poet and interject a philosopher and etc. And then they make the conclusion. Then look, this is what it says about gay rights and this is what it says about women's rights. So because it takes a lot of work, it takes a lot of time to convince people about why they should. So, like, when it comes to the reformers, and if you look at their Facebook pages and stuff, like, sometimes they share their email exchanges, is that you see, like, people, Muslims responding, is that, why should I believe you? I mean, the why should I not, like, just look at the Quran? Is that, yeah. why should I trust you to tell me what is the interpretation? I can just read the Quran.
And especially so when everybody else is telling me something different.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, sometimes is what I see, like, from the approach of the moderates and the reformers, what they say is, like, drop the Quran and listen to me.
Yeah.
Tell you what the Quran is. And for people who are able to read the Quran, they will just read the Quran and eventually try to, I mean, some of them find the inconsistencies of what the moderates are saying. But I think is, I mean, generally as people, I mean, Muslims as people, I mean, it's not really about what is theologically right, but it's more about marketing. I mean, if good ideas have good marketing and get more people to believe in them, then it's right for these people. Because, like, when it comes to religion, it's purely subjective. It's not like you're talking about whether it's science, and it's about faith, which is lack of belief in evidence. So, if you look at Christianity, I mean, it also has a lot of violent verses, but many people just don't read the Bible anymore, and eventually that led to some form of moderation.
And even if they do, I mean, just like you said, it's so faith-based, it's so emotionally grounded, because it's not based on evidence, that two people can read the same Bible verse, and based on where they grew up and based on the cultural differences between them, interpret it completely differently.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And the same thing, I mean, what I was telling you about Malaysia, I mean, Malaysia and Iraq generally are Muslim-majority countries, but... Mm-hmm. In Malaysia, I wouldn't say that their interpretation is progressive, but I would definitely say that it's much more moderate than the one existing in the Middle East. And both of them read the Quran, maybe in different language, and that could help. But at the same time, is that they both identify as Muslim. They both, I mean, they also have probably a significant amount of number that goes to mosques in that. So...
But
there
they have
so
such
many
a
other...
different geopolitical history, you know,
exactly.
In those two places.
Yeah.
And the way that they view the West is so vastly different because of the long history of both sectarian, like intrinsic sectarian conflict in the Middle East versus Malaysia, and then American intervention and just all of the negative feelings towards the West that just seem to exacerbate some of these core Muslim values.
I mean, and also, I mean, the thing about, like, Arab Muslims in general is that, I mean, Arabs used to be the ones who were colonialists.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, Arabs has a long history of colonialism. I mean, that's how Malaysia and Pakistan and many countries of Africa are still celebrating Eid and Ramadan and all of these stuff. It's because of colonialism.
Yeah.
So there is a different perception. Like, I mean, how people perceive colonialism is different. Is that when somebody, like... People like the Arabs, and I'm an Arab myself, but like, we have all this history of colonialism, and now we have a bunch of foreigners invading us.
Mm-hmm.
There's a huge feeling of defeat that's maybe not been felt by other people.
By people who have been invaded historically over the lifespan. Yeah.
Is that we were the invaders, and now we cannot even defend ourselves.
Yeah, it's
so
a pride
there's
thing.
So there is a huge feeling, I would say, of disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you have wars like Nakba, for example, for the loss with Israel in 1948 and 1967. And so there is always this continuous feeling of defeat that's happening within the Arab world. And these terrorist groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, etc., they try to address these grievances that, whether legitimate or not, which in my opinion I think they're not, but they try to address these grievances. I mean, if you look at their videos on how to do recruiting and stuff, they always say, like, look at us. Once we Arabs used to rule southern Spain, and we used to do all of that, and everybody, we converted almost half of the planet to Islam, and now we have our kings and leaders shaking hands with the infidels. And yeah. they try to address these grievances. It's like, look at us, where were we? Look at us right now, and join us so we can restore what we were before. So you'll see that like Arab culture, Arab history has some to do with like why Islam is interpreting the way it is right now in that part of the world and other parts of the world. I mean, the Soviet Union, the countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union, like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and like the Stan countries, I call them the Stan countries, other than Pakistan, is that they follow kind of much more liberal interpretation of Islam than the Arab world.
Because they don't have that entrenched history the same way that the Middle East does. And then on top of that, you can layer this, again, this unification over a common Western enemy, which is so easily just laid right into the dogma of the faith. So then you have side by side, God is great, death to America, which are two things that seem like, what? But they actually help fuel each other's fire.
I would say so. I mean, it's, they are, I mean, America, I mean, within Iraq, I mean, generally viewed as crusades. Mm-hmm. So everything is viewed within the same angle of history, is that America, the Christian crusaders are invading us, and it's time for the Muslim empire to rise again to fight against it. I don't want to sound depressing, but is that there are a lot of elements of hope within that, I mean, for the lack of a better word, a clusterfuck, there are some, I wouldn't say a large movement, but I would say that it's a rising movement, especially in countries like Iran, which has a very young population that is fed up with the Ayatollahs. And even now within Iraq, with many people seeing the sectarian violence and seeing their brothers and their family members killed so many caliphs and leaders of Islamic empires popping up, and many people are confused. So like it is, so when they're confused, they tend to be much more skeptical about what they hear.
Yeah, and it's harder for these kind of dictatorships, basically, these regimes, to maintain a bubble around their people. It's harder and harder for people to not have access to social media. It's harder and harder for people to not have access to news reports from across the world. It's very easy to maintain this sense of like unification when you're North Korea, you know, when you can just cut your citizens off from everybody and give them the narrative you want them to hear.
Exactly.
It's much harder when people can just go online and start learning things for themselves.
Yeah, and many people are learning like to be tech savvy and trying to go. I mean, in my organization, we have like courses of how to break the proxies of some of the countries, and we have like partnerships with organizations that actually do that. So many people are turning much more tech savvy, and the thing is, I mean, whatever like these dictatorships or terrorist groups, they ban something, you will see that it is the most viewed thing on the internet. So it's not really working. Is that whenever they try to ban something, you will see that a lot of people are actually watching this video and using a proxy to use this video.
It makes them want to watch it more.
Exactly, yes.
I mean, that's human nature, right? I'm not allowed to do that? Okay, let's figure out how.
Yeah, and that is something that's, I think that me as an activist from the Arab world and so many others activists are trying to capitalize on to some extent. Capitalize in the sense is that when people start asking questions and using keywords for that, we can create websites and Facebook pages that people can go to when they have these certain questions.
So, yeah, because you as an activist have really been working to utilize the technology that's available to us and figure out how to use it to your advantage.
Yes, exactly. I mean, technology is a double-edged sword. I mean, it can be used everything you want it to be. Like ISIS used social media probably much better than I do. But I mean, I have 400,000 followers on Facebook. So, and I try to utilize, and I'm was able to create it from closed society until I came to the United States. Mm-hmm. And many people in these closed areas have Facebook, and they try to use it. They create a lot of groups, they create a lot of pages, and I try to help them out and try to expand their outreach and try to help them to actually reaching as many people as possible. Because I really think that there is a lot of the gray area of the, I would say, the Muslims who are confused is actually increasing right now.
Yeah.
Because of the rise of extremism, is that many people like, okay, so we studied Islam and then we studied about the Islamic Caliphate and stuff. And now we see ISIS and we're kind of disappointed.
Yeah.
Is that we didn't expect it to be that bad. And then we look at the TV and see what's going on around the world. And that's one of the reasons what get the Arab Spring rising, even though it really didn't end up well, but some of the motivation that's happening within the Arab youth is that they look at TV, they look at the internet, they see like people living happily in the West and even in Southeast Asia and East Asia, and they look at themselves, they look around, and they see poverty, they see corruption, they see so many bad things happening, they see death and beheadings and all of that. And they're like, why don't we change that? Mm-hmm. So there is kind of, I mean, what's happening, what I think is the problem sometimes is that these youth do not have, how the American Revolution, like the successful revolutions, because most of the revolutions have failed, but the ones have succeeded have a very united vision about what gotcha. Really should be accomplished. And that is what I think, what most large number of the Arab youth is lacking is that, yes, there is all this anger, there's all these grievances, but sometimes they hardly can unite on something. That's what happened in Egypt. And mm-hmm. and is that, okay, we all hate the dictatorships, but then they toppled down the dictatorship and then they started fighting between each other.
So, yeah, and then it's who do we want to be in charge, and do we trust the army? And do I mean, yeah, it becomes very difficult, especially when you don't have... You're right, a unified view of what the future should be, because all you can think about is getting out from under this oppressive regime.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like living in a prison. It's like many people like just think about leaving the prison, but they don't think about what's going to happen after somebody leaves the prison.
Yeah, and then it's actually quite common that people get very depressed and that they have a hard time integrating. And so that's that step, that intermediate step that I know you think about every day, but that we need to be doing a better job, I think, in the West of thinking about. It's
exactly,
not enough
yeah.
just to get people out from under them. I mean, we saw that in our kind of naive movements in Iraq. And
exactly.
In Afghanistan.
I was just giving the example, exactly, is
yeah.
that there was this huge focus on Saddam Hussein, Saddam Hussein, Saddam Hussein, let's get rid of Saddam Hussein and everything is going to be fine. This is bullshit.
Yeah.
Sorry, this is not how things work. Just like there's this Geico advertising, this is not how it works. Is that you have a prison that was Iraq, led mm-hmm. by a gang, and then... You kill the gang, you have a prison, everybody get out of the prison. You have the criminal, you have the good person. And not just because somebody's against Saddam, does it make him the good guy?
Yeah.
And that's where like the theory of the enemy of my enemy is my friend is a complete failure. Because sometimes the enemy of my enemy is also my enemy.
And it's also a worse enemy, is a more powerful and more extreme enemy.
Exactly. Is that the, I mean... is that the ones who were elements against Saddam who are as barbaric, if not more barbaric, than Saddam Hussein. And the moment that Saddam was out of power and they got in control of some elements of the government, they also do, and probably sometimes worse than what Saddam was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so like the United States, most of the focus, and like, I mean, I'm myself, I'm still agnostic if the war was right or wrong. So I mean, I'm in the process of I'm writing a book about the subject. So I think it's a very complicated subject. I used to be on the side of Hitches on this topic, but I kind of evolved a bit. But the issue is that post-dictatorships and all of that has hardly been ignored by the U.S. military. And like,
yeah.
I think, I mean, if I get the facts right, is that they didn't know there was going to be a Sunni-Shia conflict until 2006. And that's 3 years after the war, that's kind of a very big mistake. And the expectation is that they thought that America is going to invade Iraq and establish a liberal democracy, and Saudi Arabia and Iran, who are the neighbors of Iraq, are just going to let it go. It's like, yeah, let this middle country just have a good life, and we're just going to sit down and do nothing.
Yeah, which, I mean, it's like, doesn't history teach us anything knowing? I mean, we've been allies with Israel for so long, and it's like, it's this, we have to keep this liberal hold in the middle of the Middle East. And I mean, look at how difficult it is just to maintain the sort of Western ideals there. And that's not even, as you were saying, you know, are the surrounding countries going to be okay with this? That's also assuming that we can, it's like we just glossed over that step of establish a liberal democracy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, wait a minute. How easy is that to do in a culture that's literally never had one?
Yeah, I mean, it's that, like, and how can these dictatorships allow even a liberal democracy around them to flourish?
Is that, yeah, it's not in their interest at all. It's exactly opposite what they want to have happen.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, if there is going to be a good role model in Iraq, then that would likely make other people in their own countries revolt against them. And that was exactly what they fear. And so you have, so like, that's why most of my focus is exactly post-dictatorships and post, because that is, I think, is the most difficult subject. You have all these elements of the opposition, and there has to be a filtering happening about who are the good guys and who are the bad guys.
And it's such good ideas. I mean, it's like climbing Mount Everest to get to the top to realize there's a whole other Mount Everest you have to climb. You know what I mean?
I would say so.
Crazy goal that then once you get there, you only have three times as much work, and it's only that much more difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it gets difficult with the time, yeah. But at the same time, I mean, I do hold some optimism.
Yeah.
And it's not a false optimism. I mean, I really based my life as much as I can on evidence and rationalism. But, I mean, there are elements of hope, and obviously there are elements that suggest otherwise. But, I mean, I think it's all about if good ideas have enough funding and enough power, they can do enormous change.
I think it's not a naive, you know, it sounds like it. It's easy for us in the West, oh, fucking hippies, and they're, you know, and they're like, oh, it's all ideology. But the truth of the matter is, I think it's such an important point that you were making earlier. All of this is because of ideology. These are ideological issues that we're talking about. This interpretation of religion, this maintenance of kind of a historical ideal, this absolute crippling fear in these cultures of losing a sense of, you know, Arabic ideals to the West.
Yeah, Arabic nationalism. Yeah, I mean, it not only defines how we act, but it also defines how we react to things. And like when you mentioned the state of Israel, is that, I mean, we can all acknowledge that the people in Palestinian people have a lot of grievances to deal with.
Yeah. And oh, of course.
Their ideology. So you can see a spectrum about how they as Palestinians address their grievances. And you can see that the power of ideology there is that there is the radical Islamic movement like Hamas and others who address their grievances in suicide bombing and in killing people who they think are liberal and are spies, even though they're not literally spies, but just kind of liberal that they thought they were spies, and the way they treat women and etc. And you can see kind of much more benevolent approach to address the grievances just by discussion and things of that sort. And there are Palestinians who are trying to do that. So you'll see what the West can do, I think, because the thing is, like many people ask me, is like, why should we intervene? We just lead them by ourselves and things of that sort. And my answer is pretty simple. If you're not interested in the Middle East is interested in you.
Yeah.
So it's like the events of 9/11 and 7/7 and the Boston bombing, etc. are not only that, is that we live in a very globalized world at the moment. Is that this, like the views of Thomas Jefferson and of isolationism and things of that sort, even though he actually the first one started the war on terror, they don't work anymore. Is that we live, like the guys who did the Boston bombing received the training on Google Hangouts from a guy living in Yemen. Okay? Is that these ideas of extremism are going global from a guy who lives in the UK and makes thousands of pounds a month, takes a flight to Syria to fight with ISIS. So, like, it's no longer about... if he's lucky, what now ISIS' new message is that commit the actions if you live in the West, so you don't need to travel. So that means that the threat is actually here in the West.
And more powerful than it would have been otherwise.
I would say so. Yeah, and I think that, I mean, also with differences of why I lived in the other two parts of the world, the West and the East, is that in the Middle East, you'll always expect to get bombed. So you actually have a lot of much more caution in your life than here in the West. So in the West, sometimes we have the illusion that everything is wonderful and nothing is going to happen. But then out of a sudden, something happens.
Yeah, and it's crippling. It's absolutely crippling. Like, it's psychologically. I mean, people who lived in Louisiana had PTSD from 9/11. Like, people who weren't even there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's a long flight, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so because, I mean, people... Like, that is, people expect, when they live here, they expect that everything is great, and that's a good thing to expect. We should not lower our standards. So, at the same time, we have to address these issues or what the grievances that these terrorist groups are trying to address and try to fight them one by one, try to fight them from different angles. And, because people join terrorist groups for many different reasons, and people have to... Like, fight every reason why these people... There are a lot of people who are doing this work, like Majid Nawaz from the Kalaim Foundation. He's also focusing on counter-radicalism, and there's Asra Nomani here in the United States. She also writes a lot about the subject. So we just need more people. We need more support, and we need more solidarity.
And it can be accomplished with something as simple as ideas. And I think that that's an important, it's not a naive way of thinking. It's actually a very realistic way of thinking that, you know, that second whole Mount Everest that's at the top of Mount Everest. Once you finally overthrow a regime, what do you do now? Well, if in the background there's been a concerted effort to change the ideology, then all of a sudden figuring out how to establish a more open society is a much easier thing to do because you're not starting from scratch, because the ideas have been seeping into the culture over the whole course of, you know, whatever the revolution is or whatever the military coup is or whatever actually causes the regime change in the first place. You have a people who are more primed for secular values. And I think that that's it's happening already.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, a simple example is Tunisia.
Yeah,
Tunisia is a country who had a revolution against a dictatorship, and now they have a liberal constitution.
Yeah, they worked together with cultures that they respected, and they looked at, you know, political scholars, and they actually drafted a constitution.
Yeah, which is pretty good. I mean, I was considered a very good constitution. And this is an Arab country. It's not. We're not talking about any foreign. So things actually can change.
Yeah.
It's just like some countries have obviously much more difficulties, and I mean also dictatorships differ. I mean, not all dictatorships are as bad as each other. Even though that may sound I don't want to get criticized for it because. But there are differences between dictatorships.
Of course, like the concept of dictatorship, the concept of a lack of election and somebody taking hold of a country is equally bad across the board. But there are people in those positions who are much more extreme. And I don't think anybody can argue with that. Like the idea, a dictator, a governmental structure that's formed on dictatorship is bad.
Yeah.
It's worse than having elections. But then there are definitely countries that are much more backward and much more suppressive because of that. I have to say, I've learned an absolute ton from you over the course of this conversation. I want to keep having it, but we're running low on time. So I hope that that you'll come back on so that maybe we can finish this conversation on another episode, because there's obviously so much more to say. I don't think we're going to solve any crises in the Middle East right here in this hour.
No.
Talk nerdy. But we can
solve 0.1%.
There you go. We're working on it, you guys. But before we go, I do want to ask you, I always ask my guests the same two questions at the end of every episode, and I'm really interested, Faisal, in seeing what your take is on these two questions, because I think that you have a unique perspective that I've never had a guest on who has those perspectives. So the first question that I always ask is, when you think about the future, what is the thing that most concerns you? What is the thing that keeps you up most at night? And then on the flip side of that, what are you most optimistic about? What do you look forward to the most?
Wow. The worst thing that keeps me awake at night is sophisticated technology with backward ideology. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Is that people like ISIS with 21st century technology and 6th century ideology, and maybe less. So I'm afraid that we're going to get more sophisticated in technology, but not sophisticated in our rationalism, mm-hmm, and knowledge and wisdom. So that's something I'm worried about. What I'm optimistic about is actually the flip side of it, the way I see it is that many people can use technology to advance a lot of good ideas, and there are many people who are doing that. So I hope this side wins over the other side.
Yeah.
And what gives me optimism is that I can see, like, I started a Facebook page from Closed Society 5 years ago with no expectation, and now I have 400,000 followers. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of nobody. And how about if more people do that? How about if more people listening to your podcast and try to listen to new things and try to spread these ideas around? And I think that the evolution of technology is double-edged sword. So it's making me depressed and making me optimistic at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think, first of all, you're not nobody. I think that you are making such a difference. You're making a difference both in individual lives, but also you're making a difference chipping away at this seemingly insurmountable problem. And I think that even just maintaining that optimism is... has a deeper effect than you could ever truly appreciate. So first, I want to thank you for all of the amazing work that you do. Second, I want to thank you specifically for the aid in helping this fan, you know, from Saudi Arabia, in helping us join forces together, and also in making sure that this young man, his life was saved. And I know that you've done that countless times for so many others. So I'm sure you don't, but I don't want you to forget exactly what an effect you have on people, because I think it's really meaningful.
Thank you so much.
I also want to thank you for coming on the show. It was really enlightening and also fun. And I do hope that you'll come back to talk a little bit more in the future. So before you go, why don't you let everybody who's listening know how they can reach out to you, you know, whether by Facebook, by Twitter, you know, different things that you're up to in different ways via social media that people can drop a line.
Yeah, sure. They can go to my website. It's faisalmutar.com. That's Faisal Mutar. And that's the same thing applies for Facebook, Twitter, everything. Because my name is not really taken by anyone. So that's a good thing. And the organization I'm working on is movements.org, and they can, people are interested in helping activists and stuff, they can just sign up and then go click add offer, and there is a form of skills they can offer to help activists in a closed society, and that's I think they can contribute to change.
Wonderful. And then that Facebook page that you mentioned that has so many followers.
It's a global secular humanist movement.
Perfect. Okay, great. Everybody, stay in touch. Reach out. Faisal, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your New York day. I hear the sirens in the background.
Yeah.
Always a busy time. I know on your end, it's like sirens. On my end, it's like garbage trucks going by. Enjoy your day. Thank you so much for joining me. Everybody who's listening, thank you for coming back week after week for supporting the show and for sharing it with your friends and loved ones. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.